for coming. As you know, this seminar series slash light seminar has in general been ably steered by Tina Eliassi-Rod. She's not available today. She left it to me. I've already managed to start late, so I'm off to a great beginning here. But the important thing is that we are absolutely delighted to have with us Chaim Hirsch, who, as a member of our department, has been for quite a long time. I was told that I cannot use the term he was a machine learning pioneer because that makes him seem old. But in fact, he was in very early on making contributions to the field for many, many years. And he has spent the last...
That still makes me feel old.
It's still bad?
No, you still make me feel old, but that's okay. I'll reciprocate today.
Okay, go ahead. I feel old every day. But Chaim has spent the last few years at the National Science Foundation heading up a division of information and intelligence systems, which apparently is a great springboard for coming back to Rutgers. I believe we have the two previous people holding that position here in the room with us right now. So, and while he was there, he was viewing things rather broadly and seeing connections between machine learning and, let's say, people. And so he's going to tell us about his vision about how machine learning and people come together in lots of really interesting ways.
Thanks, Michael. So yeah, Michael Pisani and Michael Eskar are the two predecessors to me, and the entire history there were only four people in that position, so kind of cool that we're all here together. So this is my 22nd year on the faculty of Rutgers, but many of you who are students don't know me because like 5 years ago I got approached about whether I might be interested. Actually, I've been talking to Mike Pisani, one thing led to another, and his ex-boss, who later became my boss, called me and wanted to know if I'd be interested in this job. To give you an idea of, you know, everything is going great at Rutgers. The department chair here, we're helping bring people like Michael Lippman to Rutgers. The part of NSF that this is in, the Director for Computer Information Science and Engineering, funds over 80% of all federally funded academic computer science research in this country. And so this was being one of the three division directors managing those funds within SAIS. Computer Information Science Engineering. So being responsible for roughly $150 million a year of grant money in AI, databases, human-centered computing, et cetera, was kind of a cool thing. So that's where I was for 4 years. It was supposed to be only like a two-year thing, and then I go on my sabbatical. Well, it kind of stretched on as cool things were happening, and that ended in August, and then I finally took the long overdue sabbatical. So right now I'm at MIT, but I'm actually at the Sloan School of Management and the Center for Collective Intelligence, and as opposed to CSAIL, the computer science people, and as you'll see from my talk, it's because I'm very much interested in not just bringing computer science thinking, but also behavioral science thinking into some of the core questions in computer science. For some of you, this might be new. For some of you, I'm preaching to a choir, and I'm glad that we have people here who get all this. So this is kind of where I went, and come September, my sabbatical is over. And I come back, and I'm coming back with a whole set of perspectives that didn't exist before, that came from being in very different places than the traditional machine learning stuff I'd been doing historically for before leaving. So the term that I've been using for this general set of interests is socially intelligent computing. And it's kind of intentionally ambiguous. I mean it in two ways, two sets of issues that I think are relevant to our field, both of which get captured by this phrase. The first is making computing that is socially intelligent, computing systems that interact with people in ways that seem socially intelligent, think maybe sociable computers. Basically, computing has had a pervasive impact in all aspects of our world, and yet they're still really awkward and uncomfortable to use, and they crash, and you're pulling cables everywhere, and the naturalness that we interact with one another is so far removed from our interactions with computation. And I don't mean computers solely in the sense of a laptop. I mean computational devices. How many people know about Perros, the therapeutic baby seal? It's something that was developed in Japan, maybe even as much as 10 years ago by now. It's basically a baby seal that they've shown It interacts with you, you can pet it, and it, if you play with its whiskers, it makes an annoyed sound. If you pet it, it kind of does almost like a purr sound. And they've shown that, we know that pet therapy helps patients if they, you know, if they have an opportunity to pet an animal while they're in the hospital. You know, they've been able to show similar successes with this robotic baby seal. It, it decreases the severity of people who have depression. It increases memory for patients with Alzheimer's, et cetera. When I talk about computing, I'm not talking just about a laptop. I'm talking about the broad class of things that we're creating as computer scientists and information scientists. So one is, how do we build systems that interact with people in ways that are sociable? The other sense of socially intelligent computing is that the pervasive successes of computing and the pervasive connectivity that we've created through our technologies are creating new behaviors that didn't previously exist and weren't even conceivable. And I'll give you lots of examples of things that have changed our world. I've been calling it intelligent computing arising from the social interactions of people, and actually social interactions of people and increasingly intelligent machines. And so that's the other sense of socially intelligent computing, is really about groups of people coming together to do things that we can take a computational perspective on it and ask questions about and make advances, not just as behavioral scientists studying people, but as computer scientists designing systems thoughtfully to achieve desired outcomes. As computer scientists, we think about things like, how do you build robust systems out of, reliable systems out of unreliable components? Can we take a similar kind of thinking to issues of social computing? So there's still some people standing. There's another chair over here if anyone wants. Oh, let me ask Michael. There's always pizza here.
We usually have the pizza delivered at noon. They couldn't deliver it at noon, so the choice was 12, 15, or 11, and we chose 11. So it's just gonna sit there for a little bit.
All right. Well, so now instead of being between people and food, I'm between people and cold food. So maybe it'll be less tantalizing to you, and I'll anyway. And so one of the themes you'll see is that it's not just about computer science, it's also about behavioral science, but it's not just about behavioral science, it's about synergistic coupling of ideas from both areas. Okay, so I'm going to give those two stories sort of their own separate times. So the first story is, how do we get computers to be socially intelligent? I gave you a little history where I was coming from, because for 4 years I was at NSF, for 3 years before that I was a department chair here. My sabbatical was kind of reinventing my research in new directions. There was a trajectory prior to becoming, even while I was department chair, but prior to going to NSF. So I'll give you some glimpses of some of the stuff that I'd done before becoming kind of an administrator for a few years. Still exciting, looking all at a bunch of interesting topics in computing. And then I'll talk about some of the emerging stuff that I'm just beginning to do now. So there's kind of a gap there while I was at NSF. So you'll see kind of before and after in this area. But so, how do we build computers that interact with people in socially intelligent ways? I always am so frustrated with this room, but is there any way you want to,
there's one empty chair right
there. There's an empty chair here, there's that, and there's this chair here.
You sit right there next to the computer.
And let me make sure I don't lose track of time. If we think of this from an AI perspective, the original people who were working on AI thought, wow, build a machine that behaves intelligently, that's kind of overwhelming. And they focused on individual, more narrow cognitive tasks, saying, well, maybe I can first just focus on, can I build a machine that sees, that uses language, that manipulates the physical world around us, that plays, that learns, and there's not just these five, but many others. And you know what? Over the 50 years or so that people have been doing this kind of in a coherent way, we've defined new communities for each of these. We've created our silos that we're working in. But building a machine that can see was too hard, and so we kept coming up with more and more refined questions, like, can I build a machine that can recognize faces? And you know what? Over the last 15 years or so, we've gotten successes across just about everything. So this was an example of a face detector. We can now build systems in real time as the video is looking at people that can recognize faces. And this was the first example I saw in the consumer world. So your camera now finds the faces and focuses on it. Yeah, you go back 20 years ago. Actually, Viola and Jones published a paper in CBPR, I think, or ICCB, in 2001 that had a real-time face tracker. So you can talk about this being a 10-year-old technology that translated to consumer devices in about 5 years. Human language technology, lots of examples. Dragon Naturally Speaking is an amazing voice transcription system that's been a success in the marketplace for, I don't know, maybe even 20 years. Machine translation is one that's become increasingly successful. Google will translate things for you. Not necessarily perfectly acceptably, but now pretty scarily. If you have a page in a different language, you can actually get a pretty good idea of what's going on. So we're making success on human language technologies. In robotics, boy, there's a lot of exciting stuff going on in robotics. One is household robots. You can quibble, is this really a robot? Well, maybe we're talking about robotic pets. By the way, this is that Perro the robotic seal. This is how you charge it. That a little whimsy there. So we can create robotic pets. We had the DARPA Grand Challenge that CMU won, that Stanford won, the DARPA Urban Challenge that CMU won. So we're starting to see more sophisticated kinds of robotics. These were things that we're doing driving without a driver in the car, doing pretty amazing things. The one that I like is the robotic mule. Some of you may have seen the videos for Big Dog. Here we go. How many people have seen this video? Okay. You know, this, I mean, it looks like two guys in a cow costume flipping an eye. So, success in robotics, you know, game playing, you know, 1997, Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov, the first time in a sanctioned tournament that the chess, world chess champion was beaten by a computer. Well, maybe chess is kind of idiosyncratic. Turns out we can solve crossword puzzles, exceeding that of casual human solvers, averaging over 95% word correct. This is the work of Michael Littman, a faculty member at Duke. I wonder if you know him. That was before we got him here. And of course, most recently, we can get computers that can compete at Jeopardy. This is the computer. I don't know why that's funny, but people laugh anyway. And then finally, so machine learning. So the concept of learning is so, there is a single thing that's learning. You know, we learn to read, we learn to ride bicycle, we do all sorts of things that we might describe as learning. Building a machine that learns is hard. People have created more narrow topics, like, can I build a machine that can classify things into categories? So for example, can I build a machine where if I gave it a bunch of images of faces and non-faces, could learn to distinguish between them? And we've gotten advances, ideas like boosting by Freund and Shapiri, support vector machines, et cetera. The reason I give this example is the original paper by Viola and Jones used boosting on top, basically learners on top of a library of faces and non-faces. And so the first real-time face detectors were actually the result of machine learning. And you know, this is a talk on socially intelligent machine learning. And this is one of the key reasons why I think machine learning and socially intelligent computing are intertwined. So if you look at many of the successes we have across all these areas, our successes are coming from at least three places. One is we're growing our knowledge. You know, collaboratively we build up of other people's work, just the usual way that science advances. Moore's Law has made it possible to build things. Chess program is the Deep Blue program is essentially building off an idea that Claude Shannon published in 1950, and took 50 years for computers to catch up with that, with some additional refinements. And then finally, massive amounts of data and being wise about how to harness data to do to learn from them and glean from data. And so, machine learning has become the linchpin of so many elements of AI. So we have all these amazing successes. So the first part of the story is just simply, this is pretty cool, 15 years, and we've licked a lot of the problems of AI. We bifurcated into more narrow areas, and now we're seeing successes. And people are now starting to think about, how do we bring it together to create broader successes in AI? But as people were confronting this, as we were building technologies that are interacting more and more with people, we began to appreciate there was one element that wasn't getting the same kind of appreciation and attention, and that is social intelligence. So, if you think, so each of these is coming from motive by by analogizing with some sort of cognitive trait or skill that people have. While infants are learning turn-taking and the basic rudimentary elements of social interaction before they're even learning to walk or to crawl or to speak, things like the goo goo gaga interactions that we have with infants, they're learning about social interaction. There's a whole part of our brain that's about interacting with others. And we had not been focusing on how do I understand that and build systems that can actually do that more effectively. So an increasing amount of attention has now been going towards social intelligence. And what I mean social intelligence is partially about how do we understand other people's visual cues and kind of the real social stuff, but it's also about understanding emotion, affect, motivation, et cetera. There's a whole element of our intelligence that's not covered by the things that we're traditionally looking at. And over the last 15 years or so, interest in those areas have greatly grown. Now, the talk is socially intelligent machine learning. So one of the themes you'll see in this presentation is how can machine learning enable social intelligence? So part of what I'm going to be doing is, because I've been at NSF this while, I sort of had this broad perspective, as Michael was saying. So some of this is going to be overview and give examples of different pieces of work. Some of it I'm going to just pop in some of the things that I've done. Sometimes I'll pop in things that others here at Rutgers have done, like I kind of dangled that little piece that Michael Lippman did. So the title of the talk is Socially Intelligent Machine Learning. And in the context of socially intelligent computing, where it's thinking how do I build machines that interact with people in socially intelligent ways, the question is, can we make computing socially intelligent via machine learning? What role does machine learning have in this question? By the way, I'm over-caffeinated. I normally talk fast, and then when you add in this, if you have any questions, just feel free to raise your hand, and if I don't see you, just wave it. And I'm more than happy to get questions. Any questions so far?
So computing is a loaded word, can you break it up?
Well, I mean, so...
I mean, so on, but I thought everything emanates from there.
Well, so actually there's so many loaded words in my talk. Computing, intelligent, even learning. So, in some ways everything that's technology is computing, but I'm kind of focusing on things that interact with people. Actually, later on I do try to drill down a little bit more, but it's basically computer as tool. I think something that we're using as a tool. It's computing as a mediator between people. So whether it's email or Facebook, and it's computing as entities that are increasingly having sufficient autonomy that we actually think of them as complementary partners. That still doesn't exactly answer, but it gives you a little bit more nuanced sense of what I mean by computing.
So the physicists are included.
I'm sorry?
The physicists who do high performance computing, are they included in that?
Well, not really, because they're not, if the computing is about 21st century slide rules, that's not, it's a tool for science, it's not about it's somehow about the computing interacting, essentially about computing that is interacting with people in their everyday lives. It's about
The people in Japan.
The people in Japan.
They interact with scientific results right now.
Yeah. So things like visualization of scientific data could be in this area. But there's something that's integrally. The questions are not just about the computing. It's also about the people. And so somehow you're creating a system that's about people and computing. And I'm trying to understand that intersection.
In what school are you using the term
social? These are great questions because you're anticipating kind of. So for many people, they don't think about those questions until I give them lots of examples. But it's social in at least the sense where the second part of the talk, I'm going to talk about intelligence arising from social interactions. So basically, it's social psychology. So it's about. So I'm not trying to, I'm basically using all these things in not in a scientifically precise way, but if you go with your kind of everyday understanding of the terms, that's going to get you close to what I'm talking about. You know, partly this is also an emerging area, so some of these will evolve and change over time.
So this includes like some stuff like connection, like affect, emotions, and stuff. So this is all under the scope of social.
Yeah, and I don't mean to take a strong stance that it's about social psychology and cognitive psychology. It's about people. It's about how people interact. It's also about the way people interact with computing. I'll give some examples along the way, and hopefully, if I haven't given a more refined sense of it by the examples, ask the question again. There'll be an explicit slide on that. So, any other questions? So how does machine learning create socially intelligent computing? And the most common thing that people have been doing is trying to use machine learning for personalization, watching what people do and get computers to feel more comfortable because, back in 1986 or so, I had a thesis proposal that, this is back when I was in grad school at Stanford, every time I would log in, so in those days, you'd have a dumb terminal at home, you'd connect to the mainframe, and for Unix machines, or at least probably also for the DEC 20 we were using, the machine knew what the terminal type was for essentially every terminal cable that came in. So if it was in your office, it would be programmed with, in your office you have a VT100. But if you're logging in from home on the modem line, different people, depending on when you connected, would have different terminal types. And the machine would always default to VT100. So every time I would log in from home, the first command I would do is set the terminal type to H19 or something like this. And it's like, I'm doing it every darn time I'm logging in. Why aren't you being smart enough to recognize that this is something that I'm routinely doing, right? How do we make computing be able to, so that's already 86. Now, at the time, no one wanted to be a thesis advisor to a foofy idea like that. So I ended up diving more into the machine learning, but that is the origins of my interest in personalization. We had a paper in Communications at the ACM that gave an overview of this area in case any of you are interested in a now out of date paper in terms of the examples we cite, but the overall framing of using machine learning for personalization. This was a paper that I did with two grad students from here at Rutgers at the time. Another person who's worked heavily in this is Mike Pisani, and actually just recently came back from co-chairing the Intelligent User Interfaces Conference, where a lot of the work is all about this. So this is a very active area where we're using machine learning in human-computer interaction to learn about people. And some of the stuff that we did 10 years ago now, Chunky Basu, who for a long while was at Sarnoff, just recently moved to India to become program manager at IBM Research in Bangalore. We did some personalization in the context of technical papers. We would actually download all your papers to be able to figure out what papers you might be more interested in. We'd download the PDFs and postscripts and convert it and so on. And also building recommender systems. I'm going to come back to that in a second. Brian Davison, who's now an associate professor at Lehigh, we did some stuff on Unix command line prediction, so you could actually have your Unix prompt. We actually hacked the OS so you could actually have it do some command completion for you based on your past interactions with the computer. He used some of this in his thesis work on doing web prefetching, learning sequences of links you might click on next and preload it so it'll be there very quickly. And then Sovis Meshkasi, who I think gave a talk here pretty recently, he got his PhD in bounce around now. He's the director of Fetch Labs out in California, and we did some stuff on wireless information filtering, which unfortunately was not particularly successful at the time because the technology for understanding the individual user state in wireless platforms was so rudimentary. Basically, if you wanted to know, for example, where a wireless device was, they would give us the zip code of the cell tower that you're communicating with. So that didn't really give us a lot of use. Anyway, so one dimension of socially intelligent machine learning is using machine learning to personalize. The other thing that's being used pretty pervasively is machine learning to basically understand more and more about what people are doing in their everyday activities. So if we're trying to personalize, we need to know what's going on. If it's all about your interactions with an interface, well, it's kind of self-contained. If we're trying to do it in everyday life, so for example, yeah, as I said, I'm going to dangle papers from local people. I don't know any of these people other than Dimitri. Are any of you here in the room? Okay. So, because I'd love to meet you if you were. So here's a paper where we're trying to recognize facial expressions. So you can imagine having a video camera watching me recognizing facial expressions, and it uses a machine learning approach. Some of the more tantalizing things are when you talk about computing, we start moving to other kinds of of platforms that are about computing, like mobile platforms. You know, this thing is a computer, right? So this is a project by some people at Dartmouth where they're trying to monitor you based on your cell phone, in particular the audio stream from your cell phone, and start to learn what your behaviors are based on the audio stream. Or, and this stuff is so cool. So every time you flush a toilet, you turn on a faucet in your home, it sends a distinctive shockwave through your plumbing. And what they can do is they can put a measuring device on the water intake to your house. So the water company can actually do this at the pipe that leaves them to go to your home, and they can actually measure the different kinds of pulses that are coming down the pipe and actually start figuring out things about your home. Now, it works best if we've actually been able to calibrate things like, you know, okay, flush the toilet on the first floor, they flush, they measure what the thing looks like. Once you get the footprint of all these, you can actually start doing things like, you know, the person is in the bathroom, or no one has flushed the toilet in 8 hours, so probably no one's at home. And he's done things with, one of the key people behind this is Srettik Patel. They've done things monitoring, you can put a device in an outlet, and just by passively having something in the outlet, you can figure out a lot about what people are doing. Same thing, turning on a light, et cetera. And the way they're doing this is, again, using machine learning. I mean, stuff starts getting pretty scary, but cool. As a gadgeteer, it's pretty cool. And some people at Microsoft have done work on trying to learn from watching what you're doing, when you want to be interrupted, when you don't, say, on a cell call. So machine learning is coming in a range of ways to help us create social intelligence computing. They're kind of patches in some ways. Our computer systems are so brittle, let's make them at least somewhat adaptive so they're a little bit more comfortable, or they're so sensing starved, let's try to use machine learning to get a better sense of what people are doing. Does that really, I mean, how many people watched any of the Jeopardy match? So how many people felt that the illusion of humanity was present in that match? How many people felt like it really seemed like a person was up there playing? How many people think, you know, this thing didn't at all seem natural as a person? I mean, how many people thought it was socially intelligent? Now, given that I'm still defining socially intelligent, that's an unfair question. My point, though, is I was watching this, and, you know, it's betting numbers like $947, right? It's, what U.S. city has an airport, blah, 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 and it comes up with Toronto. Some really major blunders. This thing didn't really feel like it was interacting with people in ways, that latter one was more about knowledge than about interaction. But $947 was a pretty strange number and kind of blew the illusion of, so the machine learning stuff that I've described, you know, is it really getting at the crux of this? Well, there are people, or even more, iRobot, I mean, it's this little thing that goes around. I mean, I remember, you can probably still have it in your lab. Is it a compelling example of, you know, Data, the android from Star Trek, that's, you know, interacting with people in mostly comfortable ways? Well, so people are now coming at things from the other side. So one of them is, as tool creators, we've been trying to think about how do we make our tools smarter and smarter using machine learning. The other side of this is, if our goal is to make it be usable by people, let's try to understand better what people need, what they do, how do they interact with things. So people like Cynthia Breezel have developed robots, in this case a face, with facial expressions, and they watch people interact with it, watch it mimic your face, etc., to try to get a better sense of how to convey emotion and how to read emotion using robots.
people like Cliff Ness at Stanford, you know, he's done a number of papers trying to understand people's comfort in interacting with robots. Like, for example, he has some results that show that if you participate in the building of the robot, that actually, you know, if you're trying to, it changes your interactions with it. Here is, if you have a robot that needs to tell you something that you disagree with, what's the right way for a robot to do that? And so he's conducted some experiments that are still a far ways out there, but if we're trying to understand how can robots be used by people in comfortable ways, these are people who are trying to figure out what's the comfort zone for people interacting with, in this case, robots. You know, I kind of mentioned the Roomba as in a more pejorative sense, but you know what? You know, if you don't have one, it just seems like this disc that rolls around, but there are people who are really connecting with these things emotionally. There are people who create costumes for their things. They don't want you to just replace it if there's something broken. They want you to fix their Roomba. They give them names. There are people at Georgia Tech, for example, who are actually studying, for example, that if you personalize the Roomba, it actually gets you, not in this paper, but another paper, it makes you enjoy doing house cleaning more. You know, your attitude towards house cleaning changes because you've been engaged with your Roomba. You know, Cliff Ness and Byron Reeves at Stanford had a book out, I don't know, maybe almost 20 years ago now, called The Media Equation. It's not just about computers, it's also about television and new media, but the computer part is we have social intelligence. We have ways that we interact with people, and what, through a series of results, what they've shown is we can't help ourselves. We treat our computational devices as social actors and bring all of our social intelligence to bear when we interact with our technology. And so as we build up knowledge about what are the ways we interact with technology, we can design technology to be comfortable with us. So it's not about the tool, it's not about the systems building and then seeing did it work, it's about building up a body of knowledge that we can design towards. So just as one example of some of the stuff I've been doing recently, when we think about the Watson match, it's actually kind of cool how many people in this country watched the match. It's a lens into public perception of AI, or at least this particular AI. It was understandable what it was doing, and it was well known. So we're actually in the midst of a study right now where we're trying to understand people's sensibilities about the Watson match. So for example, to what extent, I don't want to spend the whole time just on this really cool, I'm pretty excited about it. But we have a whole bunch of subject pools that we're trying to understand how different people maybe thought about it differently, ranging from MIT students and AI practitioners all the way to Catholic biblical scholars. And another group is a bunch of undergraduates at a Christian college in the Boston area. What was that?
You said all the way.
All the way, the spectrum that I'm painting is people who are maybe technophilic. So look how many hands went up, and I'm presuming a lot of you are watching it because you're interested in technology. This is not about anti-technology, it's maybe about more human-centered, people who focus on people a lot, as opposed to their daily lives isn't about the technology. So we're trying to think of what's a community we could go to that, where it's not people who love technology. And so this was, after looking at a bunch of different resources, we actually have a subject pool of almost 1,000 people that we've gotten access to from a professional society. We're expecting the percentage of people who actually listen to, who follow up on our questionnaire. We expect the click-through rate to be much lower for this community, so we have needed a big pool. Anyway, if you ask me at the end, I'll tell you a lot more about it. I think it's pretty cool. If any of you know this match, this paper, they saw a game by Hasdorff and Cantrell from 1952. It was about a Princeton-Dartmouth game. It's pretty much, you know, a 50-year later, more than 50-year later, update in the context of a game that's between two teams of people, but computing and people. Okay, so this first part of the talk has been about getting computers to be socially intelligent. The second part of the talk, which I knew I had more slides than I'm going to be able to cover, so some of this will go fast. There's basically two talks here, both of which are getting at different elements of socially intelligent computing. But the second one is getting intelligent computing from social interactions. So, you know, our world has been transformed. You know, most of the examples on the screen are certainly less than 20 years old, probably even less. And these are all transforming our world, and they're all about bringing people together through computing and networking technologies. And they're creating new things that never existed, things that we could never even conceive of doing, except for a few visionary people like Alan Kay, or, as we may think,
Vannevar Bush.
Thank you, Vannevar Bush. So here's a kind of a mosaic of examples of systems that I think are landmarks or in this area of bringing people and technology together in new ways. I'm not going to be able to go through all of them, and that spiral was a kind of a time frame, starting from there and spiraling around. So let me start off by focusing on this. How many people, Michael West excluded, recognize this image? Actually, do you recognize this image?
Well, I'm having trouble seeing it. The Steve man with the camera?
No.
It's a person looking at these mimics.
So, in 1945, Vannevar Bush published a paper, as we may think, which was proposing... basically, he proposed that scientists, you'd have this thing on your head so it could watch what you're doing, but scientists would be interacting with your information. Meanwhile, lots of other scientists are doing the same thing, and all of the different browsing and things that people are doing would be brought together, and you could each start accessing information in much more sophisticated ways than was possible. Wholly new forms of, this is 1945, right? Wholly new forms of encyclopedias will appear, ready-made with a mesh of associative trails, running through them, ready to be dropped into the mimics, and there amplified. The lawyer has at his touch the associated opinions and decisions of his whole experience, and of the experience of friends and authorities. 1945, and actually the original idea was, he published something in 1939, but 1945 he published this paper in Atlantic Monthly, and in a few months later it got published in Life magazine, and Life gave some images for what that might look like. So this was Life magazine's envisioning of his mimics. Well, you know, what I just described sounds a lot like the World Wide Web, Google, the mesh of information. You know, Google is doing some new ideas, the idea of analyzing the linkages to automatically prioritize, et cetera. You know, there's a lot of things you can do when you actually have an internet, when, as opposed to computers really didn't even exist much as networks, and he's kind of envisioning all this. I mean, if you read the paper, it's fascinating. He talks about microfilm and microfiche and how to do all the stuff with the technology of the day, none of which is relevant today, but it gave him something to start on. So, this is the logo for the GNU project, 1981 or so. Richard Stallman proposed basically having people get together and create an operating system for free collaboratively. It really took off later with Linux in, 1991 or so. Second most popular operating system on the planet, Apache, being used by over 50% of all web servers on this planet, created collaboratively by volunteers, or not just volunteers, but people working for companies that pay their people to do it because they want to make sure that the Apache project is consistent with their work. IBM pays a lot of people to be doing this, but and basically there's no owner of the software. Firefox, the second most popular browser, unless, if anyone knows, if Google Chrome has overtaken it. Actually, I just heard the new release of Firefox, actually the first day downloads for Firefox was more than the new release of Internet Explorer. So, and then of course Wikipedia is another example of bringing groups of people together on a planetary scale to create something. Instead of it being complex software, it's encyclopedias. None of these were possible, you know, 30 years ago or less. And if you look at the success, I'm sorry you're getting this, it's not like I'm getting any money for every time I put this up, but this isn't like, you know, the links on the side of your Google search page. So one of the reasons that Watson was so successful is they basically downloaded an entire copy of Wikipedia as one of its major knowledge sources for answering questions. So the existence of Wikipedia was one of the key enablers for that really impressive win of technology. This is a very sad story. Do any of you know the story of Zhu Ling from 1995?
She was, so she's a student at a university in China, I think it was Tsinghua, and she was very sick, and three of her friends sent a post to Usenet news groups, all over. One of the things you're not supposed to do is send on an unrelated topic to, but they did this. They say, please help us, our friend is sick, here's your symptoms, the doctors can't figure out what's going on. They received over 2,000 replies, of which a third of them identified thallium poisoning as the possible cause. The doctors tested, and sure enough, that was what it was. Now, it turns out they saved her life because they found out, but she's been permanently damaged for it, so that's also very sad. And there's a whole story behind that about how they haven't prosecuted the person who was the likely person, and if you go online and search for Zhuling, you can find the story. But 1995, here's a sick person who essentially got diagnosed by the internet, right? By the collective wisdom of lots of people. This is a graph from a paper that came out about less than 2 years ago now, describing something called Google Flu Trends. So this paper appeared in Nature in 2008, and the idea is, I guess it's more than 2 years ago now, so Google has a pretty good idea of the geographic location of the IP addresses that you connect to when you make a query, and they also know kind of the baseline frequency of queries for the different geographic locations. So let's do a histogram of a bunch of different queries, all of which you might conjecture might be something that someone with the flu might type in. Flu, coughing, whatever. And what they did is, if the frequency of terms that are flu-related spiked, they conjectured that there was a flu outbreak in that geographic area. And not all these people are Google. Some of them are at the Centers for Disease Control, the people who actually monitor flu outbreaks. And what they were able to determine is they could detect flu outbreaks 1 to 2 weeks earlier than the Centers for Disease Control just by watching what people are typing in as queries. If you go to their website, they actually have a map of flu outbreaks around the world by doing that. So that's what that graph here is. I mean, so I'm just excited about all these new things that technology has made possible in terms of social interaction, new forms of collective behavior. The word intelligent is kind of a scary word to some, and I'm not bringing that in for anything more than dramatic effect, but new forms of intelligence, you might say. People talk about collective intelligence, the Center for Collective Intelligence at MIT. But another example is in various areas of science, AstroAlert is a mailing list you can subscribe to. Is anyone an amateur astronomer here? So you can tell me if I get anything wrong. So there's a number of resources where some transitory celestial event happens and they say, hey everyone, point your telescope over here and get some measurements, because if we collectively, basically create a worldwide telescope, if you will, to gather data, because Pluto is going to pass in front of this star, blah, blah, blah. NASA had something where NASA is generating more images than any human is ever going to be able to look at, but what they did is they created a website where you could actually, it would give you images of Mars and you could circle the craters, and guess what? Thousands of people identifying the craters. If you take the average of that, it comes up pretty good job of finding the craters. The subsequent work on Galaxy Zoo has had over 40,000 people participate in identifying galaxies in images of deep space, and they've actually generated scientific results because of that. Things like galaxies are moving apart at different speeds relative to the density of galaxies in that particular part of space, something that was only possible because enough galaxies got labeled by the volunteer workforce. The Goldcorp Challenge, in the interest of time I won't go in, but it's basically, like many of these challenges, here's something that I want and I'm going to give money to whoever succeeds best. So in this it was, help me save my gold mine, I have this piece of land, tell me where I should be digging. And they put up $500,000. The company was failing, and as a result of their challenge, they actually are incredibly successful now. They're just in that Goldcorp challenge. Innocentive is a business where companies can post challenges they have and say, we're going to give $10,000, $100,000 if you can solve this problem. What's interesting, Bill Joy has this quote which goes something like, no matter who you are, the smartest people work for someone else. There's no way a company can own sufficient large number of smart people. So this is a way to outsource it to other smart people. And they've had problems like a more efficient way to put like toothpaste in a tube or something like this. And invariably the solutions are coming from people that aren't in the scientific disciplines that you would have expected to solve the problem.
So like in that particular case, you apparently it was someone who understood that if you somehow impart an electrical charge in the powder, it'll go in and stay inside or something like this. And so it was something about basic physics that they were throwing at a biochemist to solve and someone who wasn't a biochemist to solve. And they didn't have anyone in their company that would have been able to do that. A totally different direction, when you ask about social interactions, in mid-1970s, Apple and Hacken proved the four-color theorem, that for well-defined maps, what you want to do is put a color on each country so that no two adjacent countries have the same color. And do you ever need more than four colors to do that? And it had been posed like 150 years earlier, and they used some mathematical prowess to formulate the problem in a way that you could then give it to a computer to then do some brute force search that no human would ever be able to replicate or be able to follow. It was too large for any human perusal by eye. So I'm very controversial about whether it's really a proof, but we do believe now the four-color theorem is true, but we don't have a first principles proof of it. But if you read, and there's this wonderful book, Four Colors Suffice by Robin Wilson, and it includes quotes from Apple and Hacken, and it's fascinating to hear them say how the computer was kind of like a partner coming up with creative new ideas, because they would think they had the right way of doing it, they'd throw it at the computer would come back with something they hadn't thought of, and they're really totally anthropomorphizing this as teaching them new things about the space. And if you actually look at the language, and unfortunately my book was back home when I was preparing this, and I couldn't get the exact quote, but it's very clear that this was starting to cross the line between a computer partnership rather than just mere tool use. So that kind of touches a bit on the computational science. What's interesting is this guy named Hales at the University of Pittsburgh a few years ago says that through a similar method he has proven the Kepler conjecture about the most efficient way to pack spheres. Now, the big question is, again, socially intelligent computing, right? So again, do you trust the programs? So the four-color theorem, people have replicated the results, and so now people believe it's generally true. With Hales, he's actually trying to set up a new agenda, or he's in the midst of a new agenda, where he's not just trying to prove, but prove it using theorem-proving methods. And that follows a paper from 2005 where some people at Microsoft Research Cambridge proved the four-color theorem using a proof checker. So basically now, a computer program has proven the four-color theorem, and if you disbelieve it, you're not disbelieving the C code that so-and-so programmed, you're disbelieving the theorem prover, which has been around for decades and has been used in many different contexts. Anyway, so there's a whole political dimension to this, as many of you know. I won't go into it, except for the Iowa electronic markets. How many people know about this? So, you know, basically, just like in the stock market, you're basically buying futures for a future event, like, here's something which will pay a dollar if a Republican wins the 2012 presidential election. Here's one that will pay a dollar if the Democrat wins the presidential election in 2012. You can buy that, and if you believe the Republican is going to win, it would trade for more money than if you believe the Democrat. And so what you can end up doing is people get to invest money on different futures, and depending on what they predict collectively, if you see what the prices on these things are trading for, they're a reflection of the wisdom of the crowds, at least from a financial perspective, the same way that the normal stock market, the price of stocks, are not just, you know, a ledger sheet of how much money it's worth, but rather what people who are buying it actually think it's worth. These are no longer about, you know, Pepsi, it's about who's going to win an election. And the thing that's amazing is it's been more accurate at predicting presidential elections than any other poll, any other mechanism. So people there are being brought together through the internet to be able to participate in this online market. So, So the other part of the talk that I promised is socially intelligent machine learning, where it's about machine learning using socially intelligent computing. So what can machine learning do to bring people and computing together to achieve new capabilities and intelligent outcomes? And One of them is by watching and learning from people. So I already mentioned Google and Google Flu Trends. So the PageRank algorithm is analyzing the web connectivity. You know, I put up my web page, I chose to link to that page. Someone made a decision to do that. So by looking at all the decisions everyone made, we can figure out how to prioritize web pages. At least that was the starting point. Google Translate downloaded lots and lots of language documents in various different languages. Again, people generate language, so it's distilling those down. Some other examples that I should put up that use image libraries to create some pretty cool things like Photosynth and so again, taking images from Flickr and figuring out how to mine them to do useful things. Flu Trends I mentioned. Amazon recommender systems. I mean, I go and I start buying something and they're always telling me, hey, the people who looked at this actually went off and bought that. And that's by mining the behaviors of what people are browsing and what they're purchasing. So is this machine learning? Depends how general you want to put it, but certainly in the case of recommender systems, you know, machine learning is a routine technology being used there. But what they are doing is they're mining, they're somehow doing massive data analytics in each of these contexts. So one way that machine learning is happening is to mine people as a way to create new outcomes. You know, the fact that Amazon was able to recommend a book to me was only possible because Amazon had millions and millions of people using it to buy things, right? So it wasn't previously even conceivable that you could do something like this. And here's an example of a paper that Chumke and I had back when she was at Belcorp. Well, she was a student, she was at Belcorp, then she went to Starnow. What we did here is, the key thing in this paper, people had two different approaches. One was content-based recommendation. So I liked all these technical papers, or these are all the papers I've written. Let me mine the contents and then index it into another library of papers to say what you might like. So it's a content-based approach. Collaborative is, you like these things, here's a gazillion other people, they also liked it. You don't have a rating for this thing, but they all liked this also, so maybe I'll recommend that to you. So two complementary approaches, content-based, what's called collaborative, and people were struggling how to bring that together. And we had a paper in 98 that was essentially the first to have a general solution for bringing it together. There were a number of people roughly the same time frame. Mike was very much part of that community as well. But what we did is we reduced it to a machine learning, a classification task, and we basically described how you can formulate it as machine learning to do this. Sentiment analysis using machine learning is becoming a big tool in e-commerce. The thing that I'll leave with, like I said, I had two talks I'm giving, and I'm kind of hopefully giving you a lot of tantalizing examples and hopefully ideas. But the thing that's really intriguing for machine learning is the internet has now made possible micro outsourcing tasks. So the presumption in classification learning, for example, is I need a corpus of data, and God help you if you have to talk to people to get them to label it. Right? It's so costly to have to impose on people, it's never going to happen. Well, we now have things like Amazon Mechanical Turk, where people sign up, and the tasks are, the minimum price of a task is a penny. Many of them are a nickel. It'll take them maybe a minute to do, and if you do this for an hour, cumulatively, they've done some studies that suggest that the amount you make per hour is something like $5. People are distributed all over the world, but you can get results by posting tasks. There's an actual API, so you can do it in an automated fashion, and people subscribe as workers to be able to do this. So, for example, I might have a language task where I want people to label the part of speech of a bunch of Indian English sentences, and I can go to Mechanical Turk and pay 5 cents a pop. They do it really quickly, and I've got a large corpus. So this has transformed many areas of machine learning. People are finally cheap, and it violates the assumption that almost all machine learning is doing. Starting with a lot of the work in semi-supervised learning, where you have a small amount of labeled data, and then you want to take a lot of unlabeled data and figure out how do I leverage it. Two of the key papers, this is a popular paper. People have just been starting to use Mechanical Turk. This was a paper that analyzed the reliability of the workers. The whole process is anonymous. You're giving these out to workers and you don't know who they are and what their quality is. So somehow you have to achieve reliability. That's actually one of the big questions here. There was an entire workshop at the North American ACL meeting just on creating speech and language data with Amazon to make it become that big. In the vision community, utility data annotation with Amazon Mechanical Turk, they generate a data set of image tasks. A number of you here, Doug and Andy, have been doing things also using Mechanical Turk to get human judgments of data. The reliability issue, though, is the thing that's really looming large, and we're getting more and more people that are focusing on how do you do reliable machine learning with unreliable data sources. So people at NYU, improving data quality and data mining using multiple noisy labelers, good learners for evil teachers, efficiently learning the accuracy of labeling sources for selective sampling, whose votes should count more, optimal integration of labels from labelers of unknown expertise, and you get the idea. One of the cool ways to calibrate this is Amazon Mechanical Turk went live for the public at the end of 2005, and if you go into Google Scholar, I actually only searched on three different categories, the computing part, the social science part, and the the business part, and there were over 800 papers that came back with the phrase, in quotes, Amazon Mechanical Turk. So in the span of 6 years, it's a lot of people are now using that as a result. There's other labor sources, there's Odesk, there's people who are sitting on, who use Mechanical Turk as a back end, things like Crowdflower, that are trying to find ways to gather more reliability. But this is now kind of the big open question is, and this is why as a computer scientist I'm fascinated with this area, is can we, as computer scientists, we come up with algorithms where we can say something about the worst case scenario. You know, no matter how messed up the list is, what's the worst time it's going to take to sort this list? Or we use things from game theory to say, you know, if there's an adversary, you know, how can I ensure the best possible case from an optimal performing adversary or other forms of adversary? So as computer scientists, we have a bunch of people that are sitting there as our labor source. What are effective ways to build reliable systems? How can I program the social computer here that's being generated by all these people? That's very much a computational perspective, but it also requires understanding behavioral science more. We need to understand what motivates people. How do you incentivize people? Markets where you pay money, how much do you pay? There are results that show that if you take a task that you didn't pay people for, actually, let me give you a different example. There was a paper where they gave two different groups of subjects tasks in Mechanical Turk, one of which is, here's an image, identify the blobs, and here it, and the other was, here's an x-ray with possible tumors, and we're a project to help cure cancer, can you find the tumors? And it turns out that in the US, the click-through rate on the things that were about cancer were much higher. For the you can actually specify the task can only go to a particular country. So when they did it with the US people, it mattered. India community, it didn't matter. Anyway, so, and we're doing some work at MIT with Shade Ertekin and Cynthia Rudin. Some of you may know Cynthia. She was at Princeton working with Rob Shapiro and others, and was at NYU and Columbia before going to MIT. And so the question is, if I have a pool of experts, what's the most effective way to use them in a sustained way? I can describe more. So let me just wrap up the question about social. You know, I don't really... Let's see what I'm doing. You know, let me just... For each of these, I can take a few minutes. I don't want to... So basically, the punchline of this talk is the thing that I'm now focused on is on socially intelligent computing. You know, to a boy with a hammer, the world is one big nail. I do machine learning, so I think about socially intelligent machine learning. And the question is, how can we use the new resources that the internet has made possible to bring people together to do amazing things? How can we use that in the context of machine learning? And also, how can machine learning facilitate new things? Ultimately, the grand quest is understanding the capabilities and limitations of systems of people and computing. And that requires both understanding computing and it requires behavioral science. So my apologies for the whirlwind, but hopefully some of this was intelligible. Any questions?
So everybody who has a cat or a dog uses the name. Most people would call them neighbors. Some people name the car. I've never met anybody who named their dishwasher, and I've never met anybody who named their laptop. Is that a statement that computers are inherently less social? Wait a minute, somebody,
I know people do, but the point is, how many people, do you know anyone who named their dishwasher? I mean, the point is still valid. So sorry, was it, so let me erase the car example, but with dishwasher and so on. What was the question?
People don't name, I said, I've never met anybody who named their laptop. The suggestion is, computers are inherently less social than, for example, passing ball.
People name their Roomba.
Okay.
Well, so one of the really interesting questions is, I remember, actually I'll say this as conjecture, I read something about this and I don't remember the source, so I won't state it as a fact. People's attitudes towards their cars in the early days of cars, in order to get your car to work, you need to understand an awful lot about how it works. You need to be able to fix it, you need to crank it, you're much more physically engaged. And you can imagine people at that stage of automobile history were much more personally attached to their machines. Nowadays, you know, it's kind of a dishwasher. You know, how much of what we're doing today will be obviated by the fact that as it becomes more pervasive, things that seemed brittle and uncomfortable now become more routine. You know, it's going to be a changing landscape for us. But so part of my answer is, you know, some of this might be the passage of time, and some of the answers to that will change. Maybe people don't name laptops because they're too brittle, but maybe if they become, you know, they name their Peros, right? The robotic seal. By the way, the reason for robotic seal, they first tried doing it with a dog, but you know, how many of you have actually held a baby seal? Right? Everyone knows what a dog should look like, and you know, if it doesn't act like a dog, it's really uncomfortable, so no one liked the dog. When they made it a baby seal, no one had any expectations.
They couldn't make arms.
Well, they did some early studies that were just about petting or things like this. You couldn't make arms, but like the dog walking.
No arms, that's creepy.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, you can still.
Yeah, they're going to make a big slug.
if you search for Pero, the website has lots of papers, including the early work that wasn't about a seal. Okay. Actually, had the opportunity. Oh, here's another version of this. I actually had the opportunity to play with Pero, and you know, the results show these amazing things. People connect to them. I found it creepy. But maybe that was because I understood the technology more. I mean, I was kind of—it only has 7 actuators. I mean, it's like this really primitive thing, but people were really connected. But you know, so I would want to know. So that's in some sense what our IBM Watson study is about: is understanding to what extent people's perspectives of the technology depend on whether you actually understand the technology well or not.
So I think one area I'm not sure if I would tell me if I'm wrong is now starting to be called technology mediated. Social participation,
right?
But which is kind of letting the technology, creating, finding the right technology to enable social interaction, not just for computing outputs, but for social interaction to social action, social good.
Right.
What do you think that is?
So actually, I could have given examples in that space as well. If any of you are interested in technology mediated social participation, the concept is technology are now allowing people to be members of society, you know, contributing in a range of ways. Tools that allow you to understand the voting patterns of politicians and what they who donated to them as kind of one example. Another is helping people be able to participate in local community governance. There's a gazillion ways where technology is now allowing us to be you know, civil-minded citizens of different groups, not necessarily geographically localized. If you're interested in this, the main people who've been kind of leading the charge are Jenny Priest and Ben Schneiderman at Maryland and Peter Parolee at, is he at Berkeley or Park?
Park.
So they're kind of more focused on the outcome, which is the, you know, social participation in shared governance and social good. Some of it is really routine use of technology, so I'm not really. So I think they intersect. I think success on technology-mediated social participation requires social intelligence computing in the long run. But just like machine learning is being used in the short run for personalization without really understanding people, there's examples there also where it's about a cool tool that has had some legs in the space. I don't know if you agree with that. But yeah, it's certainly, it's the correct thing to be thinking about. It's one of the related areas.
So I'm inclined to let people get at the pizza, and Haim is here for a little bit longer. I definitely encourage people to stay and continue this discussion because it's very interesting. So thanks again for today.
And I should have my email up there if you want to follow up. I'll be back on the faculty September 1. So Kirsch at cs.rutgers.edu.